to argue for appellant, and Ms. Tanya Dahoney to argue for the state.
May it please the court, counsel. First off, on behalf of my client and myself, I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to argue here today at Texas Wesleyan. And I'd also like to illustrate two reasons why oral arguments are important in this particular case. The first is to frame the issue. That was my original point when I submitted the brief, and that is because this is a reasonable suspicion analysis appeal, and it's based on a DWI arrest. And the analysis was whether or not there was a detention with reasonable suspicion, or was that detention actually a consensual encounter. And either way, the issue is, did the court err in granting a 3823 jury instruction, which was requested during the trial? The court based their legal finding on a factual set, a disputed factual set, that was that the encounter between the arresting officer and the defendant, Mr. Morris in this case, was consensual. In other words, in the findings of fact, the judge said, or the court ruled that that was a consensual encounter. If I may just give the backdrop and distinguishing facts about this analysis that sets this case apart from some of the typical cases that are usually cited on a reasonable suspicion analysis. The first is that it is important for the court to keep in consideration that this detention or encounter or arrest occurred at a residence, so it was not on the roadside. The second is that there were no people, including the arresting officer or the detaining officer, that actually, what we call, wheeled the defendant. Nobody saw any driving by the person that was arrested.
How about the first officer on the scene who identified the appellant and
No, Your Honor. The records would show that the officer showed up and merely observed the 911 caller pointing to a residence where there was a white male standing 10 feet from the vehicle that was described in the 911 call. The second reason why oral arguments are important here is because obviously both briefs cite Derek's Wheeler, if I may. When my brief was submitted and when this case was tried, the opinion out of the Second Court of Appeals, Derek's Wheeler, was the law that was controlling. And subsequently, the Criminal Court of Appeals issued a reversal on some issues on that case. And then the state submitted their reply brief. And so this would be my first opportunity to explain why the ruling from the Criminal Court of Appeals doesn't take my legs out from under me, if I will, on this appeal. If I could just go through some of the facts that are actually not in dispute during this case, and that is at 3 a.m. in Arlington, dispatch received a call from a named complainant, Mr. Beavers, describing erratic, reckless driving by a white work truck. He went on to give speeding and failure to change lanes, and gave the license plate of the truck. Beavers followed the truck to the residence and described that he could make out a white male who exited the truck. Beavers testified at trial, though, that he did, in fact, take his eyes off of the white male during the time that he was sitting there observing this until the officer showed up. And when the officer showed up, the first to respond, the arresting officer, was Officer Lanfield. And in my brief, I point out that he did not corroborate his information, and the Dirksmiller case would say that that's no longer as important. But he didn't corroborate. What he saw was he had a call text that explained that it was a DWI complainant following, and he saw the complainant pointing to a residence. At that time, he made the decision to pull into the driveway with lights on, and blocking, it's important that he pulled into the driveway, blocking the white vehicle's ingress and egress from where it was at. Now, let me be very clear.
Your client wasn't in the car, so that becomes sort of non-sequitur.
Well, I think it's important when we get to the analysis of what is a detention, which the trial court originally or has said that it was not. I think it's important because what were Mr. Morris's or a reasonable person's options at the time that an officer pulls into your driveway with lights on and says, come here? Your options are to either get in your car or go in your house, both of which I submit would not be reasonable, and therefore that would be a detention. But getting back, I said that the lights were on. I want to be perfectly clear. The record is incomplete on this issue. There is testimony by Officer Landfield that says that my client, Mr. Morris, was very upset because of the scene of there being a police car in his driveway with the lights on. I would argue that that suggests that it's not just the headlights that are making him upset. It's the actual scene of there being emergency lights. There is also testimony that says that he was upset later on by Officer Landfield, that says he was upset because Officer Landfield had Mr. Moore sitting in a fashion where the headlights weren't inside. I want to be very clear on that, not to mislead the court on the fact that there were lights on. Obviously, if there are lights on, that makes my case for there being a detention all that much more stronger. And so that gets me to, from there, the...
I'm not following you with the lights on and the fact that the police from there in a police car, what difference does it make if the lights are on or not?
The emergency,
the lights aren't going to make them sit down or not. The police car is not going to make them sit down or not. The police officer is going to make them sit down or not. So it seems to me we have to focus on what the police officer did. I mean, he could have driven up in an unmarked car, but if it's a police officer in uniform telling him what to do, it seems to me that's the focus of what we're going to be concerned about.
And that was the focus of my argument at trial and the focus of my brief.
Okay. Right.
It is just an outlying factor in determining whether or not a reasonable or whether or not this was a detention, because there is case law that says that determining whether or not a police officer's emergency lights are on are a factor in determining that would be a detention, and that would be a slip opinion, a memorandum opinion of Sosa v. State. I can have the site for you later. And that would just go to saying that this was a detention. But the issue is, what was the officer's actions? And that's what my brief focused on. And that was what was in dispute, which brings me to my argument. And that is that the trial court made a factual finding that was in dispute. And that factual dispute was, how did this conversation take place? In other words, how did the contact between the arresting officer and the defendant take place? State v. Madden lays out the test on whether or not a 3823 jury instruction should be granted. And the test is, there must be affirmatively contested evidence. In other words, there has to be a factual dispute, and it has to be affirmatively contested. Madden goes so far as to say it cannot be mere insinuations by the defense attorney. In this case, we had a factual dispute on how the encounter between a police officer and Mr. Morris occurred. In the record and on direct, when Officer Landfield testified, during Landfield's testimony and not my questions during the trial, he said, well, I asked Mr. Morris to come over to me and speak with me. That is in conflict with, right after that, right before that, excuse me, on direct, he said, I approached Mr. Morris on the lawn. Now, the state says in their brief, that these two are not mutually exclusive. I would say that it would not make sense for an officer to walk up to somebody and then ask them to approach them.
Approach doesn't necessarily mean walked up to it. It just means walk in their direction. I walked in your direction and I said, you come the rest of the way.
The important part is that the officer did say he approached Mr. Morris in his lawn, which would indicate that he pulled into the driveway and walked up to Mr. Morris. That action versus him pulling in the driveway and giving Mr. Morris a command and asking him to come forward, that would be similar to, and that affects Mr. Morris's reasonable belief on whether or not he's free to leave. In other words, the test on whether or not this is a detention. There's a Band of the State, 890 Southwest 2nd, 42, I cited in my brief, where an officer pulled into a driveway, walks up to a party. And this officer had seen some driving, but this officer says would the driver of this vehicle please come to me? And I said that these two scenarios are somewhat similar, except the distinguishing factor and the most important factor on that scenario is that this is not a crowd where Mr. Morris is. In the Bandit case, there was a crowd, and that goes to the reasonableness of an individual feeling that they were not free to leave. In other words, if I'm in a crowd, could I rely on somebody else stepping forward? As if I'm standing by myself, an officer gives me a request, how reasonable is it for me to ignore his request and go about my business? That's the first affirmatively contested testimony by Officer Lindsay. But there's more. He went on to testify indirect that he said he had a conversation with Morris. And during that conversation, he did find out that Morris was in fact the driver of the white vehicle. But at the end of that conversation, Landfield described that he actually had him sit down, cross his legs, and wait. And essentially what he's saying is he did not detain Morris until after the conversation. But that is in contradiction to what he says on redirect. After I cross-examined him and asked him, was this reasonable, or was this detention reasonable, the state redirected and said, Officer Landfield, what happened when you showed up? And Officer Landfield said, I arrived at 0300, I detained the defendant, and I kept him detained for only 19 minutes until Officer Walker came in. And in that context, they were saying that the length of the detention was reasonable. But that also shows that the officer is admitting that upon his initial arrival, his pulling into the driveway was a detention. Those two are different fact sets laid out by the officer. The state is arguing that this is not a material fact dispute. In other words, if the trial court can get to reasonable suspicion or they're not needing to be reasonable suspicion, which was what happened in this trial court's opinion, then it would not be material. If it's not dispositive, it would not be material. We'd argue that in doing an analysis on determining whether or not this is a detention or a consensual encounter, you must determine what Justice McCoy said, and that is the interaction, what the officer's response or requests were. And so that is material because of that dispute. I'll go over the Darius Wheeler. The reason why that doesn't cut my appeal off on this issue is because that appeal or that case dealt with reasonable suspicion analysis. Now, the state would say that this is not a reasonable suspicion analysis. I, of course, am arguing that this was a detention and it should be. However, it still doesn't follow that the Darius Wheeler case throws me out. And the reason for that is the reasonable suspicion analysis that is required in this case is different and distinguishable from the reasonable suspicion analysis done in a Darius Wheeler case. The officers that made the detention, whether or not they had an offense conveyed to them in a 911 call or not, those officers saw the individual driving. They had the reasonable suspicion on a particular person. And that's the difference, is that the reasonable suspicion must be required, but it also must be established on a particular person. That's the difference in this case. There was not a particular person. The evidence was there was a white male who seemed to have gotten out of the white truck. And that's the difference between the Darius Wheeler case and this case.
Why isn't that a particular person? Since the eyewitness followed behind the vehicle, and not only did that, but then followed the vehicle into the neighborhood, presumably, but the residential. Isn't that a particular person?
Well, he pointed to a residence where there was a man standing next to a car. At the time, the officer didn't know that anything else besides that there was a man standing next to a car when he made the detention.
So what the case says is the cumulative knowledge of the 911 dispatcher and the person who followed and the officer, you take all that cumulatively and then you need to
I still go back to that not being enough reasonable suspicion to detain on a particular person.
Even though he saw him get out of the car and pointed at him when the officer got there.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
And I
think that flattery is a high form of talking, or imitation is a high form of flattery. There's a really important standard. It's cited in Dershweiler, the case that we both, of course, talk about and we both relied on in different ways. That standard started out years ago in Romero from the Court of Appeal, and of course, when we're reviewing on appeal, the trial court's decision, very much under the Hank Bear rule, we can affirm the judge's decision on any reason that upholds the decision. But you can't go back and reverse the judge's decision on things that aren't contemplated. Preservation rules and Hank Bear and wrapped up in Romero. And I think that this court had a safety Mulder not too long ago. I think Justice Livingston offered that. And actually, what's interesting is the majority opinion in the one that sent both resides at Romero standard because you can't go back. But you can come and hurt a judge's ruling or undermine it on something new. But you can always think of other reasons that were supported that might not have even been. Now, in this trial court, was the reasonable suspicion argument contemplated? No, it wasn't. This was a debate at the trial court about whether or not this was an impairment. And the other appellate standard that perhaps we ought to think about is one that always causes me fear when I'm arguing in Austin because I'm going to look at the opinion at that point and see if there's some new opinion that's going to cut my leg out from under me before I argue that morning. But in this situation, the Dershweiler case came down. That case was actually pending, and PI was granted last May. And so it was still pending on appeal. And the standard is, and it's been put out in multiple opinions, also cited by this court, but parties before the courts and the courts of appeals should proceed with caution when relying on non-final opinions. Now, Mr. Davis has done a nice job here. I'm actually doing the same thing to him because, quite frankly, Dershweiler is still pending at the Court of Criminal Appeals. I checked the website again this morning. The opinion was issued on the 26th of January. Of course, there was a 7-1-1 opinion from the Court of Criminal Appeals, not a case that from the Court of Appeals that the arguments were granted 5 months before the brief was filed. But it looks closer to final. So, in proceeding with caution, I'm hoping that I'm showing prudence, but it is not yet final. And technically, cases that are not yet final are not always part of the jurisprudence, as another appellate standard that we ought to look at. This case is the fact that Sawyer is my favorite. It's 727-280. It's the Court of Appeals from 1987, and it relies on the Mr. Murphy's case that was one of the first to say that. So a couple of appellate kind of housekeeping things apply. Again, deferring to the facts that we have below, and again, there's wonderful, thorough fact-finding and conclusions by Judge Mitchell. And they show that according to Mr. Beavers, he followed someone who luckily didn't kill someone. He's traveling over 100 miles an hour on the freeway, going east from apparently from this area here at Austin. Almost clouded the back of Cape and also many of my other cases that were not so many. Swerved to not find the back of
911, he did what I call every good Samaritan that we do in his office. I want to make sure that this person knows it from the first time and it's going to be more accountable for their bad life. He followed them all the way, past Fielder, past Lamar, into Good Pines Drive, where there the person driving the car hopped out and was in the front seat. And while it was earlier said that nobody wheeled the defendant, Mr. Peters testified in this trial. He saw the defendant. And then, of course, the defendant said, we have to wheel him down. It's nailed. There's a coffin on that issue. And whether or not reasonable suspicion as to a particular person, well, if you can't see the person in the car, what are we going to do about these cars that have tinted windows? Or what if this car was a huge truck and poor Mr. Beavers was in one of those smart cars that Judge Womack drives? You know, we look at someone who couldn't see the driver. But if that person followed them all the way home, saw one person on white mail and on the front lawn in front of his house, next to the car that had just been exited, Mr. Beavers was still on his cell phone with the dispatcher. I believe that the call sheet showed three different instances over about 9 minutes where he was talking to the dispatcher saying, yes, the white mail's still out there. Lo and behold, there was a person who was really driving. But in the lower court, they only debated consensual encounters. But we know from appellate cases in the past that often more than one legal reason upholds an officer's conduct. And y'all probably laugh and keep count of how many times I can rely on some of my old cases. Makes me think of Stacey Bryant that this court had, where there was a consensual encounter, and the court said not only was it a consensual encounter, but it was also out of court. So there were two reasons to uphold the contract that the officer had with the citizen that was arrested in. Here we have two reasons, and because one of those reasons does not have what we're calling for argument's sake, which is the fact that the reason of suspicion rule, then the third prong is that Judge Hoffman, how to figure out whether or not you need a 3823 instruction opinion. Which was the legal issue presented here. And since the instruction was denied below, the trial court was correct in doing that, even though there was no contemplation in the lower court that reasonable suspicion applied on appeal, and we don't know, and I'm sure this court has been doing that a few more years, then obviously that rules. And the way it magnifies the three prongs, and in Mr. Davis's brief, he addresses prong three that I addressed in my brief, and three that unfortunately cuts the leg out of the defense case in this situation. Because under Dershowitz, there was a reasonable suspicion. And actually, under Dershowitz, a couple of the cases cited by Mr. Davis also showed that there was a reasonable suspicion. If you apply the cumulative good knowledge, just as Gabriel has talked about, they are cases that involve citizen informants calling and following people in the same manner. Of course, brother from this court, and then as a court of criminal appeals from this court, also involve citizen informants calling and giving rise to what ultimately becomes investigative detention and then the report suspicion of how they call people to die. It's really pretty simple, thanks to the Dershowitz case. Recognize it is still pending. The motion for the hearing extension was filed in that case, and it was granted, and it was due on the 24th of February, and it has not yet been filed, which I'm not sure whether Phoenix government has confirmed it, so it may be about to be filed. That being said, I'll concede, of course, the competition in the United States Supreme Court. Always a possibility. So, again, I always want to recognize when I'm thinking of something that is not. But the ink is not completely dry. In this case, Dershowitz just solves the issue. Unless there's any questions, as far as Dershowitz or Madden,
I perceive what you're saying is that there was a consensual encounter, and if there wasn't, and there was contention, there was reasonable suspicion in either case of administration.
That's right, Your Honor.
One sentence.
You do it much more concisely than I do.
Thank you, Mr. Honey. Mr. Davis, rebuttal.
May I please report? Just a couple issues that were brought up. First is that the reasonable suspicion argument wasn't contemplated at court. I'd ask the court to remember that there was a motion to suppress based on reasonable suspicion to obtain a probable cause to arrest filed before this trial was brought. The decision was to run that motion to suppress during the trial. And if you reflect on the record, the judge even corrected the assistant district attorney at one point, asking the scope of the motion. And the judge said the scope of the motion was determining the legality of the detention. So that argument, I think, was addressed at the trial court. Another issue is that going back to whether or not the car being blocked in was an issue, I took that from Garcia Cantu, and where the court acknowledged, and which was cited in Dirksworthy, which acknowledged that the act of a police car blocking in a vehicle is a very heavy factor in determining whether or not there was a detention involved. And my final remark, my request for the court to consider is 3613, Code of Criminal Procedure, that requires that all issues of fact are the domain of the jury. And we had a disputed fact. It was material in determining whether or not this was a detention, or whether or not it was an encounter, or whether or not there was reasonable suspicion. Either way you want to go, it's still material, because you have to determine how the conversation took place. And that would have been
well. What is the fact issue of reasonable suspicion if we follow Gershweiler or however you say that case?
The fact issue was that this case is distinguishable from Gershweiler because that case did not address the particular reasonable suspicion on a particular person.
That's hardly what you've done, Barbie. Are you just hanging your hat on the fact that there was a person standing there and somebody took their eyes off of it momentarily? I mean, what? I really wasn't following you. Honestly, your argument earlier about why that dog didn't hunt.
Well, I mean, the Dershweiler case does take a little bit out of the argument there, in that they said the cumulative knowledge of the law enforcement.
Right.
In trial, a lot of this went to whether or not what the analysis was, what did the officer know at the time of the detention? And so that was a lot of the focus on that. But as the state would point out, the issue here is whether or not it's a detention or a consensual encounter. And so frankly, Dershweiler, while informative, really isn't relevant when determining whether or not this judge or the trial court made a decision and should have given it to the jury, because the issue was, if I may wrap this up, the issue was whether or not it was a detention or an encounter. And so reasonable suspicion would not come into play as far as whether or not it's a detention or an encounter.
And you know that Dirtweiler doesn't come up with this cumulative language on an OLC site previous cases. So even if this case is turned around, obviously there's other cases that support the same footnote. Footnote 32, according to the opinion, cites a 1987 criminal sex combat case and a United States Supreme Court case.
Okay. We stand on the brief and ask that it case be remanded.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Thank you, Mr. Honey. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted. And you all are now excused and we will adjourn court. Amy, thank you for having us here today at PWU. It's always our pleasure.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.